Okay, everyone, welcome back. So we're ready to start with the last two talks of the day. And the first one was going to be about Daniel Bohn. So please.
About me. I hope not.
We were just saying how tired everyone is after the end of towards the end of the conference. So it's a talk by Daniel Bohn.
Yeah, I'll try and get you smoothly to the drinks. But not before thanking Emanuela, Peter, Wilson, and Jeff for organizing such an incredible meeting and an incredible place. I think they deserve a little round of applause for that. So I hope I won't disappoint you. What I want to do is to take you to the microscopics of friction, and then in the end come back perhaps to the S-shaped flow curve and see whether we can directly connect the two. And so the friction work is the PhD thesis of Bart Weber, who used what I call magical molecules, because I'm a very bad chemist, made by our chemistry department, and they were part of the PhD thesis co-advised with my colleague from chemistry by Tomislav. The S-shaped flow curve measurements were done by another PhD student, Song Cheng, whom I'll refer to as Bruce because he refers to himself as Bruce. And I'll show you the beginning of some simulations done in collaboration with our informatics department by Vishnu. So if you by now are not yet convinced that there can be friction in suspensions, you can go all the way back to 2005. Annie actually already mentioned this paper with Guillaume, where we actually did measurements of the friction coefficient of this granular suspension, and we found a friction coefficient that was in perfect agreement with the angle of repose of the dry powder. Yeah, and so there is friction in suspensions. But what is friction about? That's a very difficult question, as you all understood after Jay's talk. And what we really want to do is to look at the microscopics of the contact between these little beads that are touching each other clearly because there is a friction coefficient. And so, as Jay, I will try not to repeat too much of what everybody already said, but yeah, this is almost the last day of the conference. But so one of the great things that Da Vinci already showed is that he could move blocks with a certain force over a surface, and it didn't matter whether he put the block on the side or on the short end or on the long end, they were all, he needed the same force for to move these the same block, but with different contact areas. And so the gospel nowadays is Amonton's law, which dates from 1699, and we've not been able to do very much better, says that surfaces are always rough, and so it can be that the actual contact area between two rough surfaces, or in this case a rough surface and a flat surface, is proportional to the load that you apply. If the thing flows at its yield stress, that might even be true. So then the real contact area is proportional to the load. And the friction force, if then the friction force is proportional to the contact area actually drops out, as Mark also already told you. And that means that the friction coefficient is well defined, as we find it to be. However, measuring this real contact area is actually very, very, very difficult. And so there's very few measurements. Jay showed you a few, Mark Robbins showed a few last week, but there's very few really accurate measurements of the contact area, and that would be needed to understand why the friction coefficient of these beads is 0.4 and not 200 or 0.001, right? And so one lovely thing to think about, also already mentioned by Mark, is that if you believe that the contact area is proportional to the load, you're immediately in trouble if you think about granular suspensions, because that's a Hertz contact between two spheres, And since Hertz, we know that the contact area between the two spheres, or between one sphere and a plane, goes as some constant that depends on the modulus of the material and the radius of the beads, times the load, the normal force to the power 2/3. And so I was like, I'm gonna prove Amanton wrong. And I attached a bead to a rheometer. And a rheometer is a lovely instrument to do friction measurements, because it measures the normal force and the shear force, the friction force, very accurately. And so what I did is I took one of these PMMA beads and I glued them to the rheometer and I started to turn. And at the same time, I can look from below and verify that the contact area indeed goes as the force to the power 2/3. But if I measure the friction force as a function of the normal force, I get this really lovely straight line. And you see why the rheometer is so nice. I have about 200 points that I measured in a couple of minutes on this graph. And it's really a lovely straight line that goes through the origin. And so there's a problem here, because Amanton says the contact area is proportional to the load, and Hertz says the contact area is proportional to the load to the power 2/3. And so what needs to be done is to actually measure the real contact area. And this is where the magical molecules come into play. Our chemistry friends make molecules that light up when you press on them. And if you do so with a rough sphere on a surface covered with magical molecules, this is roughly what you see. And so if you want to know a lot more about this, you can read the paper of Bart that is coming out in the coming week, we hope. But I want to do this experiment because I really want to understand what this friction is all about. And so what our chemistry colleagues do is they can treat a glass slide and chemically attach these magical molecules to the glass slide. And if you take a pen tip and you don't push on the molecules, nothing happens. And if you push the pen in, you can actually see that it starts fluorescing. Yeah, so what I'm going to do is I'm going to take my rheometer with my eccentric PMMA bead, and I'm going to push it onto the surface. And I also have a confocal rheometer, as many people here. And so I can look from below at what the actual contact looks like. And so this is what we see. The movie already plays. Yeah, so this is a rough PMMA bead that we push on float glass, and float glass has a roughness in the nanometer range. So this is a rough bead on a flat surface. And so the first thing to do if you want to understand friction is to try and understand the contact mechanics of what happens here. And so we're continuously, or in steps, increasing the force here, of course. So this this image is about 120 by 120 microns. So the bead itself is big, is here a few millimeters, but the contact is actually rather small. And so the neat thing about this technique is that you have molecular resolution in the Z direction, because these molecules only start fluorescing when they are confined at the molecular scale. And so the roughness of the bead turns out to be larger than the scale of the roughness turns out to be larger than the optical resolution of the microscope. And so we see the whole contact. And so if we now plot the contact area as a function of the load, we're immediately in trouble because Amanton says that it should be a linear curve. But of course, it cannot remain a linear curve for all of the experiments, because if I have an apparent contact area that grows as the force to the power 2/3, then at some point, if I press hard enough, my real contact area should become larger than the apparent contact area. And so I have to cross over to herd behavior at some point. And basically for this PMMA beat, this happens rather quickly. Another interesting thing to note is that the slope, or the inverse of the slope actually here, of this graph is the stress that is exerted at all these different contacts. And if you have a fraction of a newton, so there's something missing here because it's definitely not square meter. This should be square micrometers. If you divide the two out, you easily reach several hundreds of megapascals. And so we are very gently, yeah, with something like 100 grams, pushing on this bead. And so even if you push very gently at the contact, you already have stresses that are several hundreds of megapascals, and several hundreds of megapascals are very close to where the PMMA actually starts to flow, the yield stress of PMMA. I'll come back to the green symbols. The static friction force actually follows the contact area. But so we really need to understand this if we want to understand friction. And so what Bart succeeded in doing is taking an AFM image of the exact region of the sphere that was going to touch the glass surface. And then he could do the experiment. And then what we did is we sent the AFM image to our collaborators, Lars Pastewka and Till Junge, who were then at the Karlsruhe Institute of Technology, and who do discrete element simulations of such contact. So you have a rough surface with the roughness given by our AFM image in contact with a flat thing. And so don't ask me how the simulations work. You should invite Lars for that. But they can, using a discrete element method, then predict what our contact looks like. And there's no adjustable parameters because we know all the mechanical properties of all the materials. And so this is what it looks like in the experiment. And this is the first result that Lars and Till sent back to us. And this is the contact model that all the people in contact mechanics use, Greenwood Tripp, or almost all the people in contact mechanics use. And you see that it grossly underestimates the true area of contact. Again, there's no adjustable parameters here. So there's clearly something missing in our description of the contact mechanics. And so the first thing that we added after discussing with Lars and Till is elastic interactions between the asperities. So the asperities are elastically coupled through the elastic material of the sphere. And so if you push at one, that will actually affect the contact of the other. And so if you add that, you can improve a little bit, but you're still more than a factor of two of the real contact area. And so the only way that we could get agreement between the experiment and the simulation is to add a plastic flow of the asperities, and we even had to add a little bit of strain hardening in the simulations to get to the good agreement. But if you do, you can actually see that up till the smallest details, because these are the same spheres basically in the experiment and in the simulations, and that's what these green islands here show. That's just to show you that the simulation actually really describes the whole of the contact mechanics. Yeah, so this is progress in contact mechanics, but it's basically pretty bad news for people doing friction and contact mechanics, because A, the standard model doesn't work, and B, if you really want to describe what happens, you have to add all kinds of system-specific details. Yeah, and so again, these are three images at three different forces. Now, of course, we also want to do the friction measurement, because Avanton's law was contact area is proportional to load, and friction force is proportional to contact area. And so the way we do these experiments is the same rheometer with the same bead. Sorry, I should have told you, I now know what I forgot to tell you, that we can do the experiment and then put the bead back under the AFM and look at exactly the same area, if you're patient and good enough, which Bart is. And then we can indeed see that the mountains of the asperities, that the asperities are, have been flattened. So also in the experiment, we actually do see this plastic deformation of the asperities. The friction experiment is, instead of just pushing, we continuously increase the torque on the bead, trying to move it around, and then we see a small, very small displacement until it starts to move. And I can now show you what that looks like in a movie. I hope. You see all kinds of things happening. This blue thing in the middle is simply a scratch on the PMMA bead, and then it starts to move. And so comparing this with what Jay told us yesterday, friction is fracture. I think this is actually not really fracture. It's not as collective as the plexiglass blocks of J. And so I think of it as a sort of brush with elastically that is elastically deformable that starts to move over a surface. Yeah, and so it's much less collective, I would say, from these images than what Jay actually told us. And so there's lots of neat analysis that you can do on this, but the million or perhaps even billion-dollar question, friction is of course extremely important, is what about Hamilton's law? And so what we can do is we can plot the peak force, that is the static friction force, as a function of the measured contact area, and lo and behold, we get a lovely straight line. And we get a lovely straight line. We even use different materials, different sizes of beads, different chemistries of beads, Teflon, polystyrene, PMMA. If we just rescale the force with the modulus of the material, we really get a lovely straight line. I don't understand why this should be such a lovely straight line. Yeah, I think the billion-dollar question now lies here, because we actually understand the contact mechanics in much detail now. But why the friction would be proportional to the real contact area, I can only understand if there's adhesion. That would make sense, but we tested for adhesion and there's actually none. And so the upshot is, if you plot the contact area as a function of the normal force, we actually get a sublinear behavior. And the red line here is now the simulations of Till Jung and Lars Pastewka compared to the experiment, and it works extremely well. However, the generic models in contact mechanics are the green one, which is without elastic interactions, and the blue one, which are with elastic interactions, and they're off by a factor 2 to 3. And so this is serious for people doing friction mechanics. I told you the friction force is very nicely proportional to each other, but then if you plot the friction force as a function of the normal force, instead of getting a well-defined friction coefficient, you get the same sublinear behavior as you've seen here. And so the upshot is, if you're two Egyptians that are trying to build a pyramid, random example.
As a Jew, excuse
So this is actually wrong, Itai.
That's not how we do.
No, so every time you go to a conference on friction, there's somebody showing this this dragging of a statue through the desert that we also worked on, and so I discussed this extensively with a lot of Egyptologists, and what you can see is that there's three rows of people with different clothing on the tomb drawing. I can show the tomb drawing at the end of my talk, and they were basically the farmers working the land, the army, and the noblemen of the kingdom. And so they might have been Jewish, but they were not slaves. The farmers you can still argue about, but the rest. Yeah, so the upshot, if you're two Jewish Egyptians that are trying to build a pyramid, it's actually cleverer to put the stones on top of each other before dragging them than each pulling a stone, because the contact area can be sublinear in the force. That might actually be easier. And so it's not Amontón's law, it's Amontón's flaw. Amontón was actually wrong. It works exceptionally well in an exceptionally large number of situations, but if you really go and look at the details, you see that the devil is in the details. Okay, now back to our granular suspensions, because what we wanted to understand was, if I do a rheology experiment, and these are the same PMMA beads, they're a bit smaller, we can density match them, we put them in a Couette cell, and we do constant shear rate and constant shear stress experiments. Can I see the friction? And so we've seen this graph from Bruce already a number of times. We can have the S-shaped flow curve, and many, but not all of us, believe that the upper branch has something to do with friction. And so I would really like to see whether I can use my magical molecules to see whether I can really see the friction in this system. And so what we do is we have our confocal rheometer, but I've taken away the single bead, and I've now put a suspension of particles in between. And the particles have now been coated, again by our friends the chemists, to have these magical molecules on their surface. And so, lo and behold, if I'm just at the start of the shear thickening regime, I can see a couple of frictional contacts, and then if I go to the top of the curve, I actually see a lot. And I would have loved to show you the movie, but my confocal microscope is not fast enough to actually do the 3D imaging. And so I cheated a little bit here. This is a shear plane very close to the glass slide. And the glass slide has a slight ordering effect on the particles, and that's why you can actually see all these contacts in the same plane. But it does show that in our system we have frictional contacts. So what we can do is we can now try and reconstruct in 3D the contact network, and we cheat a little bit there, but we can make all these 2D images, we can get the centers of the particle positions, much less accurate than Itai, of course, and then we can reconstruct the 3D particle positions. And so from that, and from the fluorescence intensity, we can actually get the contact network, which is really terribly complicated. However, I've cheated again here because I've already told you my confocal microscope is not fast enough. We're hoping to improve it. So what we did here is we got a very concentrated suspension, and we tried our best to shear jam it, and then we made the stack of images. Yeah, and so if you do that, then you can get the whole contact network in 3D. And I still believe that these are good, bona fide, frictional contacts, We're trying to improve the microscope by having a high-speed imaging system attached to it, but that turns out to be much more difficult than we actually hoped. But there is hope, and so what? Five? Okay. If we can measure these contact frictional networks, we can actually compare them to the simulations that Vishnu is doing. So this is Vishnu, and Vishnu is where in the audience? Vishnu is sitting there, and he has a poster in the other room. So he can tell you everything about his simulations, which are lattice Boltzmann. And so the difference with all the other simulations is there's an explicit fluid here. And I think that is important, and we'll explain to you why. But we can, from the simulations, we can also get the frictional contact networks. And so if we have a continuous shear thickening, you have the fraction of the particles in friction that is roughly a half. So what lights up here are the particles that are part of a frictional network, sorry. And so if you have DST, you can actually see that almost all the particles are part of a large cluster that spans the whole system. It fluctuates, but it does span the whole system. And so last 5 minutes, we also tried to look into the vorticity banding issue. And so these are the flow curves of the same suspension under constants, under imposed shear stress and under imposed shear rate. And the difference between the two, together with the fact that we have this backward part in the flow curve, strongly suggests that there should be an instability somewhere. And if you measure, and this has also been shown already a couple of times, if you measure the viscosity in the S-shaped, it strongly fluctuates. And so all this could suggest that there is shear banding. Peter spent quite a lot of time thinking about this. And if there's shear banding, it should be vorticity banding because it's a shear thickening transition. Yeah, and so there should be a band at this stress and a band at that stress. The problem being, of course, that experimentally it's very easy to measure velocity. It's very easy. It's relatively easy to measure velocity profiles, but to measure a local viscosity or a local stress is actually very complicated. But my chemistry friends actually came to the rescue because they have molecules that also light up when they are in a viscous liquid. And so this is a brother of the molecule, of the magical molecule that I already used. It's in water, water glycerol, and in glycerol. And you see that the higher the viscosity, the more intensity. And so whatever we do, we look at these molecules, at the fluorescence of these molecules before and after shear thickening. We look in the vorticity direction, in the gradient direction. We see no inhomogeneity. We do see something surprising. This is the intensity as the function of stress. And you see that for the discontinuous shear thickening case, the intensity increases almost discontinuously to a very high value, and the increase is a lot smoother for the more smooth continuous shear thickening transition. But this poses a puzzle because the molecule here is dissolved in the water, and how does it know that it is in a shear thickening system? And so we thought about this for a very long time. And the answer seems to be that it doesn't measure the viscosity in this case, but it measures the pressure. Yeah, so this is actually the way that we calibrate the fluorescent probes. We put them in a solvent and we pressurize, and the more it gets confined, the higher its fluorescence intensity. And so why would there be pressure effects? Well, this is because of the famous boundaries that Morten is always talking about. If you have a shear thickening system, it wants to dilate. It can only dilate through the boundaries. And that has a strange effect on the measured stress and normal stress. So purple and blue. In an oscillatory shear experiment, you see that there's a very long time attenuation of both effects. And we think that this is because there has to be, in order for it to dilate, there has to be fluid flowing through the porous medium. And the smoking gun for that is that actually if you go to large amplitude oscillatory shear, and this is an imposed strain, which is the black curve, the purple curve is the stress, and you see a little shift, but that's simply viscoelasticity. However, here, the stress and the normal stress were perfectly in phase, and here you start to see a phase shift. And the normal stress should really follow the strain, because this is an elastic effect, and so it should be instantaneous. And so if it's not instantaneous, you get a phase shift. And the fact that it's not instantaneous means that there's fluid flowing through the suspension. And we actually came to this because we had discovered this effect in biopolymer gels. And so if you want to know more about that, you can read that in this paper. But it's basically you have the particle pressure pushing up. And if the system can dilate a little bit, then fluid has to flow in. And then you have a liquid pressure that goes the other way. Yeah, and so there's a lot of very confusing, I think, normal stress measurements in this paper here. And so conclusions. Yeah, I'm done. I think we have a really neat tool to study friction, shear thickening, etc. These magical molecules, I think they can be used for many, many things. The contact mechanics is subtle and system-specific. And then perhaps the most important conclusion, shear thickening is of course due to the emergence of frictional rheology. However, in the last two slides, I showed you that fluid transport is also very important. And so I would propose that we start talking about frictional hydroclusters. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Nick.
Time for questions. Nick was the fastest.
That was fascinating and well placed towards the end of the week, I think. Getting back to the Jewish pullers of the large objects in the desert, they probably weren't made of PMMA, these objects, right? And I was wondering if you'd looked at the behavior of non-polymeric materials when you push them against the glass surface, and whether it looked any more linear. Because when I teach Hamilton's law, I usually say Hamilton's law works for an extraordinarily large number of materials, but not generally for polymers.
This is it. Yeah, so Itai, you can see that they're all wearing different things. And so the puzzle here is why somebody is versing water in front of the sledge. To answer your question, I think it's very system specific. So we've done PMMA, Teflon, and polystyrene for the polymers. We get either plastic flow of the asperities, or for Teflon, you even leave a layer of Teflon actually on the substrate. And so the contact mechanics is difficult and system specific. For wood on wood, I would expect the same thing.
Right, but these are all polymers. What about a metal surface?
We've tried. The problem is that if we use harder materials, we actually scrape the magical molecules off the surface. So that's a bit unfortunate. And
but what you mean, you could still do the simple compression test, right?
And so we've done that, and we think it's still plastic flow of the asperities. So I think that Greenwood trip should be abolished.
Right. Right. We should talk more about that.
Yeah. Yeah, but the stresses at these contacts are huge. Yeah, so unless you have a roughness that is very smooth, you will always be so we had 100 grams of force, and we had pressures of several hundreds of megapascals. Yeah, so
Mark Robbins, the slope basically is what determines that pressure according to what the recent contact mechanics challenge and other things. So I think the elastic contact problem is well resolved and the world pretty much agrees. And if you have an RMS slope of the surface, like John Royer quoted, of 0.1, then that tends to give you stresses that are 5% of the Young's modulus, and plasticity in polymers is unlikely. If you have rougher surfaces, then you cross over into the polymer limit. In both cases, you get an initial linear behavior determined either by the elastic model or the yield stress, and it crosses over for a sphere to this two-thirds power law. But that's very specific to the sphere. If you have a granite block that's a meter by a meter, that saturation in the area proportional to load should happen much, much later, because you have a statistical distribution of asperities. So I think in the tribology community, there's a number of experiments with single sphere on flat, where they do see saturation in the two-thirds power law in the high load limit because you cross over. And I just wanted to comment on your statement about adhesion. So one of the things that Lars and I did was look at models where there's local adhesion. And what we showed is the local adhesion can be quite strong, even equal to the cohesive energy of the two solids, and yet it doesn't look adhesive. That is, when you bring things together and pull them apart, there's no force needed to separate them. And
why do you call it adhesion then?
The local interaction, as in the case Jay showed, could be welding. You can have, you know, really strong adhesive energy. The problem is that you're storing so much elastic energy in deforming the surrounding surface that that's able to peel off the adhesive regions, so it doesn't look sticky. So you can have local areas with adhesion with a constant stress without having it stick, which is why you and I can't be Spider-Man, which is another story. But because, I mean, basically our fingers are just like geckos in terms of locally being van der Waals adhesive.
Yeah. Interesting. Thanks.
Oh, yeah. It was just a very basic question, but the very first measurement that you showed about friction for a sphere, I think it was showing a linear relationship, so I was a little bit confused.
It's very confusing, friction. So we're basically in the linear regime. So
no, not that one. But
exactly. But we're here.
No, but the very first measurement that you showed, where you were showing that, yeah. Oh, this was for glass. This one.
No, this is. Oh yeah, this. No, glass on glass, yes.
So this one shows linear friction. It's not like the polymer case where...
No. So it all depends on the force range. So if you're gentle enough, it's linear. But as soon as you start to really push, it becomes nonlinear.
This one, did you try to look at the real contact for glass beads also?
So glass is the same problem as the other hard materials. We scrape the molecules off the surface. So we need a more robust chemist, basically.
So, awesome. Can you say something about the magical molecules? So the rotating ones, I think I get the resonance that you get some sort of charge transfer for the fluorescence. But the static ones, what's the magic?
So the magic is that you shine in a photon, and then it can easily dissipate that energy to the environment by a rotation around this bond. If that bond becomes hindered in its rotation, so confined or under high pressure or in high viscosity, then the molecule has no other choice than to emit that energy as a photon and fluoresce.
Right. So how do we... So it can be a high viscosity. I mean, I guess in some sense it could be solidification of a fluid layer would be enough. Now, maybe we don't care about whether that's, you know, real contact or not. It's effectively the same thing. I'm just trying to think about it in my head. I mean, is it... doesn't have to be real contact, it just has to be, like, how much of an increase in the viscosity do you need to get this to happen?
Well, so it's, in viscosity, it's actually a power law behavior called Forster-Hoffmann with a very small power, the intensity as a function of viscosity. The power is typically 0.1, whereas for the contact mechanics here, for 95% of the intensity, it's really on-off. Uh-huh. It's either there or it's not. And so the 5% we can still discuss about because it's interesting, because it would allow you to measure a pressure locally. But for most practical purposes and all experiments I've shown here, it's just on-off. Mm-hmm. And so it's not gradually increasing. Yeah, so if you look at the intensity distribution, there's really a peak that is well away from zero, and there's not a whole continuous distribution.
And sorry, it's along these lines, and basically in the two cases you're using two different chemistries for the molecules, for the static ones on pressure and the one that are just sensitive to the viscosity.
Well, they're brothers chemically.
Right. Any further questions?
Garrett?
Just a very quick one then. If it's on or off, you're contour maps show an intensity. It goes from yellow to orange to red.
So we shouldn't read anything into that that color change then? Because it should really be black and white maps then.
Well, so there's of course some background noise, and there's some width of this distribution if it's on off, and that's the 5% I was mentioning.
I see. Okay, so there is a small a steep change over a small range.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
So I understand the pictures you showed us with these, you inferred contact maps from the presence of these regions. Technically, you were identifying in the particle-particle, you know, in the actual dense suspension. So technically, what you were seeing is immobilized regions, not necessarily a normal force, but just immobilized. So if you had no fluid in between, is that right?
Yeah. So if there's fluid, it's off.
But identifying it with a frictional contact is one step
frictional
farther.
Frictional hydroclusters. I mean, what more do you want?
Maybe just a very last quick comment. Have you tried to look at rolling contacts rather than sliding contacts?
No, not yet. It's on the program.
All right. Thank you very much. I think on that note, we can thank Daniel again.